forgetting that they should speak English.
We don't have our own foreigner, but he will definitely be listening to the recording, so I should speak English. I hope you can follow me reasonably. I'm trying to speak slower. So, as I said, when I had 3 hours, there was enough time to watch the movie together. Now we don't have that time. There will be, my remarks will not take the entire class meeting, so what I will do is I will start the next topic, if we have any time left, because the next topic takes longer. So, between the meeting today and the next week, we should be able to cover also the next topic, which is finding research problems, asking research questions. But let's talk a little bit about the working of scientific enterprise based on the movie. I found the movie really very nice. I watched it in the mid-1990s, and it was fascinating, really very interesting movie to watch. Those of you who have watched it, hopefully you enjoyed it. It's physics, it's not exactly what any of you is doing, but there were several really important elements that I wanted to discuss, to pay attention, your attention to, in that movie, and discuss those mechanisms working in science based on that movie. An important message that I want to convey is that this science has social character, and those of you who watched the movie probably noticed that. We can stress it again, but there was a lot of social. There were a lot of social interactions in the movie. And the three basic mechanisms of science: publications, grants, and peer review, and then some concluding remarks. That's the plan for today. As I said, very short presentation. We are at the beginning of the semester, of the course. So the first thing. This was the link. I checked it before sending you email, and it is still working. Even though the movie is copyrighted, I think they are not chasing people who published it. So it is around 50 minutes. In fact, we probably could squeeze it today and watch it together, but now we can't do that, because some of you watched it. You may be bored by watching it again. So here are the things that I wanted you to pay attention to, how the scientists got into the research areas. You noticed a lot of things that were a little bit accidental, right? Croto, one of the Nobel Prize recipients, because those people got Nobel Prize for the discovery, wanted to study architecture. Right? And then he got into chemistry, right, or physics, one of the two. And the others were also, there were a lot of accidents. Remember the guy from Utah, I think, who went to Germany and spent some time with another guy who showed him something interesting. They spent some time on it. A lot of accidents. A lot of accidents happened to you too. You have chosen an advisor. How did you choose your advisor? I bet in many cases there is something accidental in it. There are very few cases when people know exactly what they want to do, and that's all right too, but for many it's at least partly accidental. Picking the problems to work on, we'll talk about finding research questions, identifying research questions and problems, you notice in the movie that there were a lot of accidents there too. Especially the doctoral students, they got to work with somebody, and that somebody found something exciting, asked them to do something in the lab, and that was the beginning of their dissertation. How did they get funding? There was a spectrum of things. First of all, difficult to get money, and then as you noticed, once they made a discovery, money was pouring. Everybody of the funding agencies was doing, me too, me too. Me too wants to give you money for that work. At some point, the guy, I think Croto, said, I withdrew money from my wife's bank account to fly to Texas, right? Things like that happened too. Later, he probably had a lot of money because people wanted to fund him. The same happens with startup companies as it happens with research. Once you are successful, once you do something, everybody wants to give you money. But in the beginning, it's hard. It's everywhere, really. Artists, they are struggling. They have barely enough money to live. And then once they become famous, everybody wants to buy their work and pay a lot of money for it. Publishing was also there. Remember, there was a paper in Science. Science is one of the major, absolutely, journals. But there were also papers published in small conferences, in workshops. We will talk about that, how it works. Global science. It doesn't matter where you are, where you got your PhD, who you are. You notice people from all over the world, especially towards the end of the movie when they interview some of the Exxon employees. You notice there were some Indians, some Chinese, people from all over the world. The two guys who made the discovery, one of them was British, one of them was American, they got together to work. The world really has no borders. Once you get your PhD, you can go anywhere in the world, and most people will just accept your PhD. Well, they will not question where it is from, although it helps when you get your PhD from a famous place with a famous advisor, that helps a lot. But the world will be open to you. PhD is a ticket to work in research, work at at a university or in research. And that's what you will get when you get your PhD. Networking important. If you notice, a couple of things, very clear. Kroto could go to Texas because he knew the guy. He got to know him, but he was an acquaintance that he met in a conference. And then the guy from Utah, I forgot what his name was, he went to Germany. Somehow he met that guy, yes? And then later they had a paper also. So that acquaintance lasted. Types of scientific career paths. In Poland, typically with a PhD, you go to work at a university. But you notice in the US, some people worked at universities, some worked at research centers, industrial research centers. And there are also other possibilities. So we'll talk a little bit about that at some point, maybe not today, but later. So, Buckminster Fullerenes, those of you who watched the movie, remember that this is in honor of an architect, Buckminster Fuller, that was his name. Forrest Gump, Buckminster Fuller. So, some of the remarks, some of my notes when I watched it. So, there was a variety of ways of getting into the research area. Picking hard problems, but once, problems that people care about. Kroto said it, carbon is very, very important for physicists, for chemists, because it's the foundations of the universe. It's so important that when they propose a new form of pure carbon, they immediately get people's attention, immediately. Even if it had no applications, they would get people's attention. But Buckminster Fullerenes have important applications because they are very, very strong, very robust. So a lot of research followed that discovery. Important problem. Unusual experiences were also another thing that was in the movie. Kroto wanted to do architecture. Something went wrong there. He didn't go to do architecture. He knew the work of Buckminster Fuller. He didn't know him personally, I think, but he knew the work. He'd seen those geodesic forms, right? Looking like balls. And that gave him the idea to think about the new form of carbon as a sphere like this. that's an interesting thing. We will come back to that idea when we talk about creativity. Creativity is something that you can improve, and creativity is something that you can be primed on with your past experiences or your current experiences. They may bring you ideas. And that was exactly what happened here with Kroto. He knew how those structures looked like, and he thought, wow, maybe carbon with the three, I think, right? Three different connections is connecting to other carbon atoms like this, only to carbon. Enthusiasm. You've seen that when the music was also good, you know, there was the Latin credo, kind of, you know, really the music brought this atmosphere of something important happening here. People were enthusiastic. Remember the lunch when Kroto was leaving Texas, they were doing different kind of modeling with gummy bears, with marshmallows, etc. They were enthusiastic about what they are doing. And the importance of thinking, I will be stressing it many times, thinking is what we are doing best. So thinking is very important. And there were also many coincidences. You've seen things were happening almost by accident. There was also persistence. Kroto withdrew money from his wife's bank account to go. The doctoral students were, you know, running in the lab. You've seen them moving things around, connecting them. The Smalley, Kretschmar was from Utah, I think. Smalley was from Texas. He was talking about connecting several power supplies together. I mean, enthusiastic about this and persistent. Funding, that's an important thing. There's a page in the slides on funding, but to do research, you need money. Once one of my colleagues said, it's amazing what you can do with money. That's true. Money is maybe not the most important thing in the world, but it's amazing what you can do with money. If you have money, you can buy computer equipment, you can buy laboratory equipment, you can send your doctoral students to conferences, you can travel to conferences, you can hire doctoral students. In US, usually it's the advisor who has the money for the student. So it's not like here where the country, the government is paying your stipends. Typically, the money comes from a research grant of your advisor. So when the advisor has the money, wow, that's nice. The advisor can hire students who can do a lot of basic work in the lab. Money is important. And very good universities have more money. Why do they have more money? Well, they have better researchers. Better researchers are better in bringing money because they are better in publishing. When they send a grant, proposal for a grant, reviewers are looking more favorably because they see, oh, that grant application comes from MIT, and that's a very good university in this area, right? So probably they know what they are doing. It's a safe bet, probably good proposal. It's harder when you are in a smaller place, especially when they don't know you. If you are competing for European grants, probably, from Białystok University of Technology, we are okay. The variance in Europe is not huge. So Białystok University of Technology is, I would say, if I look at the United States, it's probably a good university. The variance in the United States is enormous. You have top universities where there are several people or many people who have Nobel Prizes, who are famous, really very good in their areas. These are universities that you can probably count with the fingers of your both hands. I'm just spitting out some names. Harvard, MIT, that's Boston, Massachusetts. Then Yale, then Princeton, Cornell, Carnegie Mellon, University of Chicago, then we go south. University of Texas is also well known. Purdue University, Then we go west, California. We have Stanford. That's not enough, the fingers. We have UCLA, University of California at Los Angeles. We have Berkeley. I probably have skipped something, but each of these universities that I mentioned is world-class, very, very good universities. Then we have Carnegie Mellon. Did I mention Carnegie Mellon? It's also very good at Technical University. And then we have a lot of kind of good universities. And then we have a lot of universities that are so-so. United States is a mess because there is no Ministry of Education like we have in Poland, in most European countries. So every university decides what they teach, how they grant the degree. Any of you could go to the United States and say, I'm creating a university, Kowalski University of Technology. You know, print the business cards, you create a web page, and you grant bachelor's degree, master's degree, and doctorate. And you decide about the rules. You say, okay, it's enough that you show up once, and I'll give you a doctorate. And then you give a diploma, doctor of philosophy. Mr. Wiśniewski is a doctor of philosophy from Kowalski University of Technology. The problem is that that university is not known. Nobody knows it. And when it comes out that it's a university that gives the doctorate based on showing up once, like what we had in Poland. What was that university in Wrocław? Remind me. It's still an affair. Collegium Humanum, right? In Poland, it's a scandal, and it's really an illegal activity because they have violated the rules of the Ministry of Education. In United States, there are no rules like this, so you decide what you base your degree on. So Collegium Humanum would thrive in United States for a little bit, just a little bit, until people realize that the graduates from Collegium Humanum know nothing. Then Collegium Humanum or Kowalski University of Technology get bad reputation and they essentially disappear. Nobody wants their degree, even though it's very easy to get. So there are universities like this where you can buy your degree, but there's also, because of the mess, they also created accreditation. So there is an organization that is created by good universities that is able, that is visiting the universities, looking at their program, and then putting a stamp. This is a good university, right? Still, they don't tell them what to teach, how to teach it. They don't tell what the program is like in Poland and in most European countries, but they essentially declare that this is a good university. So Kowalski University of Technology would probably not get accreditation very easily unless they pretend to teach or they really have a good program. So it's a mess. How does Białystok University of Technology position in that mess? As I said, probably a good university, not the top, far from the top, but a good university. Most European universities are good. Very few are in the top. What are the top European universities? Oxford, Cambridge. Maybe Sweden is, I hear it a lot in good context in computer science. That's the Uppsala, I think. Well, there are a few good universities. Well, there are some Italian universities, very old, Padua, Bologna maybe. They are not the top, like, you know, top American Harvards and so, but they're good. They're better than the average in Europe. But the variance is small. Most of the universities are good. If you have a Collegium Humanum, it will disappear. Most likely it will disappear, right? I think. The scandal is too difficult to hide. Or they will have to reform themselves, kick out some people. So doing something what they were doing is not a crime in the United States, but it is, of course, illegal in Poland. So it's a mess, and good top universities have a lot of money. There are several ways they get the money. So Harvard, for example, or any of these that I have listed, one source of money are the grants. So faculty apply for grants. They get a lot of grants because they are good. The faculty are good. Why are they good? Because it's a prestigious university. It's very difficult to come in, to be accepted. So they get the best people. It's an honor to work for Harvard. And even if they pay you less, you want to work there. That kind of, you know, puts a nice stamp on your resume. So they have very good people. The good people bring good money. There's another mechanism that I don't see in Europe yet. I don't see it here. The other mechanism is called endowment funds. These are the funds that are essentially gifts from other people, companies, people, and graduates. How does it work? Well, you graduate from the Bielsko University of Technology, and you think, well, it was a nice university. The faculty, the professors were nice. I'm nice to you. 5 or 10 years after your graduation, you are building a successful career. You have money. You created maybe a company. You are successful. So I'm kind of not me personally, but there is an office at the university called Alumni Relations, so relationships with the graduates. And they knock on your door. They send you email. They call you and say, well, you know, we have this stipend program for students. We are kind of collecting money, and maybe you would like to donate something. And you decide, well, you've been successful. You say, oh, okay, I can donate 100,000 zloty. That's nothing for me today. I will donate it. Another, they will also call some people and say, well, you can, if you have more money, you can also create a chair. A chair is there's a physical chair, actually. They order it from a carpenter. But it's a chair called, for example, Kowalski Chair in Computer Science. That's the name of the chair. And to get a chair, you need to, say, donate $1 million. From that $1 million, they invest it, and then the interest is used to pay the salary of the faculty who is in that chair. So they actually recruit. They announce, we are looking for a faculty who is going to be the Kowalski Chair in Computer Science, and they hire somebody, of course, very competitive, because it's an honor to be faculty called Kowalski Faculty, Kowalski Chair Faculty, Professor of Computer Science. And they pay the salary from that funds. Another thing is you can donate to call a department, Wiśniewska Department of Computer Science. Carnegie Mellon, I think there is either Bill Gates Department of Computer Science or somebody big. To get that, of course, you need to give not $1 million, but you need to get 50 or 100 or whatever, bigger amount. You give it, and then they have that money, and they invest it, and the interest from that money is essentially used to do different things. So there's usually a lot of money. To do that, it's not working here yet, you need to be nice to students, right? That's an important thing, because the students have to have good memory when they graduate. So that's the mechanism, essentially. Then when they have that money, they have enough money to pay students. So when they offer PhD studentships, they offer high stipend, and they recruit students. Students can come with a guaranteed funding. That's a very nice thing, isn't it? So they get also the best students, prestige of the university, money, which is there, good university. They get the best students. They get the best faculty because they can offer higher salary and prestige. They get the better students. You know, it's a self-propelling thing. It's very difficult as a university in such an environment, competitive environment, to get to the very top. Because you need tradition and, you know, it takes time to develop that, to get money for the endowment fund, etc. But it's amazing what you can do with money. If you get that money, then you have money, like Texas. They had a lot of equipment. They had an accelerator, which is very, very expensive. Big labs. Everything is big. It's very difficult to get to the top, by the way. There are very few exceptions. All of the universities that I listed, they are very old. Very few universities are young. Carnegie Mellon, that's probably late 19th century, the beginning of it. That's a young university. Harvard, Stanford, you know, these are 19th century or older. At Caltech, I didn't list it. Caltech is very, very good. It's an exception. It's a young university. I think it's first half of 20th century, maybe 1920s, 1930s. It's very small and very, very good. Many Nobel Prize winners, a lot of money. But it's an exception rather than rule. All of those universities are usually old. It takes time. So for Białystok University of Technology to get that far would take another century probably. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try, right? You should try to do that. So now, why that long story? That some places have money, more money than other places. And it's just an unfair fact of life. But who said that the world has to be fair? The world is unfair. I was born short. I cannot play basketball. Tough, right? I can play it, but I will never be in the National League, right? I'm too small. I'm too heavy to be a horse rider, a jockey, right? My eyes are not that good. I may not be able to be a sharpshooter. I'm too old now to run sprint. So things that are unfair. And the unfair thing is that, you know, some people are, some places are very, very rich, have a lot of money, other places are poor. I forgot where Croto, the British guy, came from, but I bet his university did not have as much money as Texas. So he wanted to spend his sabbatical leave in Texas to go to a place that has a lot of resources. Everything is big in Texas is a saying. It's like Americans sometimes say it. Big buildings, big roads, whatever. There's a Polish joke about Texas. I'll tell you that. It's a short joke. It's really a Polish joke about Texas. A blind man goes to Texas. He goes to the plane. They tell him where to sit. He sits and kind of feels around and says, wow, so much space, such a big chair. So he says to the stewardess, to the flight attendant, you have really very big chairs in this plane. And she says, sir, it's Air Texas. And everything is big in Texas. So he understood that and flew to Texas. He landed in Austin. It was still early, so he thought he would go out and have some beer. So he goes to a bar and orders a glass of beer. And they put on his table something that looks like a bucket. He kind of feels it huge, terribly huge. And he says, well, you have really big glasses here. And the waiter says, the barman says, it's Texas. Everything is big in Texas. So he started drinking the beer, and kind of halfway the bucket, he felt the need to visit the restroom, toilet in British English. Restroom is the American. Americans are a little bit more prudish, I think, right? They they don't use bad words. So restroom, you rest there. So he wanted to have a rest. He goes there. He asks the barman, where is your restroom? Oh, very easy. You go to that door in the corner, turn right, then left, then right again, second door to the left, and then is the restroom. After the half bucket of beer, he lost the way. And instead of to the restroom, he ended up in a swimming pool. He stumbled and fell into the water. And started shouting, please don't flush, please don't flush. So that's a joke about everything is big in Texas. That's not the universities, that's the state. But they often say that, everything is big in Texas. I think Smalley said that, the Texan guy. Once you show something, it's easier to get money. You saw that very, very clearly when they were in the beginning. They just had an idea. They were doing their studies. You know, they had to bring things from home, a vacuum cleaner. They had to buy some power generators from Sears. I think Sears is like, a builder's. Well, it's actually a big supermarket. Department store, not supermarket. But then, once they got some publications, people realized that they were onto something. They had something important. The money started to pour in, just pour in. That's also very upsetting fact of life, the unfairness that as a young beginner, artist, engineer, a scientist, you have to struggle. But once you show what you can do, things become easier. And things will become easier for each one of you at some point, of course. Hopefully earlier than later. Sometimes they use the personal funds. It may turn out to be a good investment, but not necessarily. The money from wife's account was to buy the air ticket. Smalley brought the vacuum cleaner, so they were not worrying about the money too much. Publishing is another thing that you observed in the movie, that the original movie, the original TV, it was a TV program, was called Race to Catch a Buckyball. The word race is here the important one. They were racing. There was a competition. If they revealed what they were doing to other people, and in fact they did at some point, suddenly other people started working on it. So it is a race. In science, there's always a race because only the first gets the reward. Sad fact of life, but only the person who makes the discovery as the first gets the reward. Others will just rediscover the wheel, as we say in English and Polish also. That's maybe ingenious, very smart, but you don't get the reward if you are not the first. At some point, paper after paper was produced. They actually show it in the movie towards the end of the movie. Hoffman and Kretschmer. Kretschmer was the one in Schwarzwald in Germany. Hoffman was the one from, I think it was Utah, if I'm not mistaken, or Arizona, somewhere southwest in the United States. When they read about these buckyballs, Buckminster Fullery, suddenly they thought about their experiments years ago. And they went back to that, and then they published a paper in Science, I think it was, when they actually visualized the Buckminster Fullerenes. Croteau and Smalley, the ones who got the Nobel Prizes, they created that competition by opening a new idea, a new direction of work. They worked together. So Croteau went to Smalley to Texas to work there. Could he return to England, as he did, after the lunch or dinner when they were in a Mexican restaurant, they were putting together the things. He went back and then realized something. Could he have published things on his own? It would be better for him, right? One author, not two authors. It would be Croteau, and that's it, right? And a big title. And now he had to publish Croteau and Smalley. Croteau and Smalley. Could he have done it?
Probably not.
Well, he could have, but it wouldn't be very, very nice, and it would not be very honest, not very ethical. Right? That's the answer, really. We will talk a little bit about authorship of papers at some point, maybe when we talk about writing. But please know that it's a very delicate situation. He spent a lot of time with Smalley talking about it. There were a lot of ideas, a lot of things that brought him to where he was. It is similar to a married couple who has a child. I don't know if you've ever known somebody divorcing, quarreling in a family. Maybe you did. At some point, in such a situation, people say, no, this son is so good, it's really my family, and, or these bad things are from the father, or from the mother, of course. Suddenly that child, everybody wants to have, to see, is this mine, right? But that's, of course, ridiculous, because the child has the genes of the father and the mother. You cannot just start dividing that child, saying, okay, bad features are from the father, good from the mother, or vice versa. The same, you can think about intellectual contributions of two scientists working together, two or three. So when you start meeting with your advisor monthly and discuss things, then at some point it's actually very difficult to even say which contribution is yours, which is the advisor's. I remember once there was a case, I had a student, a very smart student, a doctoral student, and we had a very good paper, it was well received, really a breakthrough thing. And I think a few years later, two, 3 years later, I was just sitting with him in a meeting and said, well, I asked him, the idea I had to do this and this, that was a good idea, wasn't it? And he looked at me and smiled and said, this was my idea. And actually, I don't know whose idea it was. I'm not bold enough to insist on my idea. I thought it was mine, but it might have well been his. It's very hard to actually remember, because we were discussing things, we were drawing, we were brainstorming. It's very difficult to say whose idea it was. The same like a child of two people. It's a mixture of both of the parents. So when you start working with somebody, when you work with your advisor and meet regularly, it would not be ethical to go and start publishing the things that is directly related to that work on your own. That would not be ethical. If I were your advisor, I would get angry. The same, if your advisor starts publishing things that he or she discussed with you, you were working on it together, you may be rightly upset about this. So it's not ethical, it's not nice, but it's not ethical to do it. That would be comparable to intellectual theft. You steal something from the other person. You appropriate ideas. So the moment they started working together, they produce together. Of course, if they do other things, that's a different story, right? But the things they were working on, they are together. The parents should not divorce, but they should take care of the children and let them grow up in a good environment. The same here. Of course, it happens. The parents divorce. It happens also that two scientists get quarrels. That happens too. Not too often, but it happens. May happen. Unethical behavior also happens. Not too often, but it may happen. I mentioned in the beginning the social character of science. If you look at all of this, you know this boy. I mean, there are so many factors. There are so many accidents, interactions. I got somebody. I know somebody in Schwarzwald. I can go there, right? I can visit for a few months. It's so social. Those two people working together, right? They can be not nice to each other. They can quarrel too. They are not quarreling. It's all so social. Huffman and Kretschmer. If they had a quarrel when Huffman was leaving Schwarzwald, it would have been difficult to publish that paper in Science, right? But they were probably nice to each other. They would send Christmas cards, send an email, hi, how are you doing? So it was very easy to get back together. The world is small, and there are not really boundaries. So the fact that you are working on your PhD in Białystok, you could have just as well work on your PhD in MIT, Carnegie Mellon, Berkeley. Really, doesn't make much difference. You can do good work. The only thing that you have in your disadvantage here is probably less money, because I bet there are fewer grants. You have to rely on your stipend, which allows you to live. And in fact, you should live on your stipend. You should consider not distributing your thoughts elsewhere, like working full-time somewhere else. But it's a third disadvantage. So the disadvantage is probably, with all respect to the scientists in Białystok, there are fewer extraordinary people than there are at MIT. I think even the faculty here, the professors here, will acknowledge that. I hope they will, because it's a fairly objective measure in all respects that those people have published much more, they have more discoveries, they have done more work. So you don't have as many impressive types that you can learn from. Remember from last week, you learn from other people. So fewer such people, you learn less. That's the disadvantage for you. But otherwise, your thinking, your working, etc., it could happen anywhere. It happens here, and it's very global. Once you graduate, you can get a job anywhere. With a PhD, you can try, and you probably will get positions in many places. If you don't get a position at MIT, Berkeley, Carnegie Mellon, or Harvard, it's probably because there's a lot of competition. There may be people who are more advanced than you, and they will maybe get the job. But why not you? You could also get the job if you publish something very good. It's very global. You notice that especially in Exxon, you notice that the many foreigners there, right? They got their PhDs maybe in US, maybe somewhere else. We don't know that. We didn't say that. The world is small. The skills, the way it works is everywhere very similar. There are some places where funny things are happening, but those funny things usually make it a disadvantage. So like when I noticed that many of the openings, jobs in Białystok or in Poland in general, they are not real competitions. Very often the announcement is because we want to hire Piotr, we want to hire Piotr, so we write an announcement. We are looking for somebody who... Piotr, what did you do? We write that for Piotr. And that in the long run is harming that place, because they are not getting the people they could if they announced it widely to the whole world. They would get the best people. But otherwise, you can do good work and bad work anywhere you are. The world is small. Networking, absolutely. Remember, it was on this list. We are not going to have any special meeting on that, but just observe. How did they get that place for sabbatical leave? I found a funny thing in Poland. I find you get additional points for spending time in foreign institutions or something. They ask you about this. You get points for that. How do you get those places? Well, you just ask people, can I come to you? How do you ask them? Well, you can ask them not knowing them. You can just send them email. But it works much better if you meet them in a conference. You have a chat and you make a very good impression. They like you. They think you are smart. It's much, much easier. That's the way these people did it. Kroto got a position in Texas because he must have impressed Smalley. What is the most valuable resource for Smalley? He has the lab, he has the money, he has students. What is the most valuable resource for him? Time. That's the most expensive thing for him. He doesn't want to waste time with somebody who is not good. Why would he? So he wants the best people. Anybody who has any brain wants the best people working for him or her. So looking for the best people always. So if Kroto impressed Smalley, Smalley agreed for him to come and spend some time in Texas. The same with Hoffman and Kretschmer. Another thing with networking, very, very clear in that movie. There was an interview with Kroto, the British guy. And remember, they made a discovery, they published it somewhere, and they were trying to observe the buckyballs, the Buckminster fullerenes. They were doing experiments with that. And suddenly, Kroto gets paper from a friend sent to him with a note presented at Capri, the workshop in Capri, an island in Italy. Can you believe it, right? And then he realizes that those people are far more advanced, and they actually describe how to produce the Buckminster fullerenes. Why did he get it? Why did the person go through the trouble of copying the paper, writing a note, and putting a stamp and sending? Because he was a friend, a colleague, and he knew that he knew Kroto, so he knew he would be interested. That's the value of networking, of friendships. Another thing that is worth looking at in the movie is the structure of laboratories. You notice that there was a professor, it was all in Texas, there was Smalley. Then there were postdocs. I think there was at least one or two postdocs. And then there were research assistants. Research assistants are doctoral students. They are hired to be research assistants, and the money they get is serving as a stipend. And also, they are paid the tuition. Tuition is the money that you pay to study. In the United States, studies are not free. You have to pay to the university for the privilege to study. And these can be a very significant amount of money. I would not be surprised if the annual tuition now at the top universities that I listed is around $100,000. You have to pay around $100,000 every year for the privilege to be a student there, including being a doctoral student. Stipend, typically, you get a stipend, the money in your hands, plus the tuition benefits, so you don't need to pay that tuition. That's a lot of value, a lot of money. Usually these are the research assistants, doctoral students. Postdocs are people who have just finished their PhD, and they want to gain more experience, they want to learn more. How can you learn more? Well, you go to the best places that are the best possible places, because in those best possible places, you have the best possible people, and you can learn from them. So that's the idea of a postdoc. Once you finish a PhD, you go and spend 2, 3, 4 years as a postdoc. There are, of course, exceptions, but this is a typical way of doing this. I'm one of the exceptions. I never went to a postdoc for a postdoc position, but I'm really more of an exception than a rule. I was lucky. I got a faculty position right away. Typically, you do a PhD studies, you get a PhD, you spend a few years as a postdoc, and then you get a faculty position when you stay at a university. Consider doing a postdoc, although I noticed one characteristic that is very different in the United States and in Poland. People in Poland are not very mobile. So typically, I bet most of you, I don't know for sure, but I suspect most of you have lived in Białystok already. You get into the PhD program because it was the university that's close to you. Once you graduate, you will probably also stay around here. Of course, there are exceptions. We have somebody from very, very far. But typically, people are not very mobile. In US, people are much more mobile. You grow up in Oregon, and you go to study in New Jersey, across the continent. You finish your studies in New Jersey, you go to do a postdoc in Texas. And then you look for a faculty position, and you go to Michigan. So very easy to go to different places. Very rarely, they hire people who are their own graduates. So if you finish your PhD in, MIT in Boston, you have to be absolutely exceptional to get a position at MIT. They usually advise you to go out somewhere else. Why do they do that? To prevent genetic inbreeding. Genetic inbreeding, hoof sobne. Intellectual, of course. You've learned from this place, you don't have ideas from other places, go somewhere else. We will hire somebody from another good place who brings us fresh blood, fresh intellectual blood, of course, fresh ideas. So it's typical to move around. So if you are willing to move around, I absolutely recommend you doing a postdoc position somewhere. They will hire you, no doubt about this. You can go and do a postdoc in other European countries or United States, Australia, Asia, wherever you want. You can go and try and find a position, the postdoc position. That's something between a professor and a doctoral student, and you are still learning. You notice the structure and also the work that they were doing. The assistants, the doctoral students, were doing the dirty work. They showed it in the movie, very funny. The guy was bringing some stuff from one room to another. That was the PhD student, right? He was doing the dirty work. Of course, somebody has to do the dirty work, and you may think, okay, as a PhD student, I'm being exploited, I'm being abused. I wouldn't look at it this way. It's a symbiosis. You get a lot in return. You learn while doing the dirty work. You are learning. In a few years from now, other people will be doing that work for you because you will learn enough to be actually independent and on your own. So that kind of structure where somebody is doing the dirty work, and you know, the further you go, the more higher level things you do, that's everywhere in the world. Nothing unusual. Of course, that can be also abused. Of course, they may send you to do coffee. Well, it's not your duty to make coffee as a PhD student, right? But it's not unusual. You've seen it in the movie. Scientists in US, you notice that majority is foreign-born. Why is that? It's not because Americans are stupid. Absolutely not. There are many smart Americans. But in most places in US, there is this atmosphere that I really like there, is that you always look for the best people. If the best person happens to be a foreigner, okay, what's the problem? Right? That foreigner speaks English anyway. You all speak English, so they will hire you. Not a huge disadvantage because you are a foreigner. If you are just as good as an American, they probably will hire an American. Why? Because writing is easier, speaking is easier, they are a native speaker. But if you are good, you will be hired too. So you notice that, especially in that towards the end, in Exxon, you see people speaking with all possible accents from all different countries. Majority, in fact, is probably foreign-born. It's a little bit like in Białystok, maybe I noticed in computer science. Because salaries at the university are much lower than in the industry, a lot of people want to work in the industry. It's in our department in computer science, it's actually difficult to attract somebody to become and work with us. I think it's a temporary thing. It's a fluke. You should never use this as a consideration. You should always think about your long-term place. Where do you want to be? Because things like salary and so, you will actually manage as a faculty member. You will find sources of funding that will make you not really disadvantaged financially compared to people in the industry. Typical working places for scientists. You've seen that also in the movie. Not all of them, but you've seen some. Universities. That's Smalley and Croteau, University of Texas. Kretschmer and Huffman, also universities. Then you saw Exxon, Industrial Research Labs. But there are other possibilities. Many PhD students, graduates, have an idea. They work on something that they judge to have commercial potential. What do? They graduate, defend, and start a company. It's actually, many startups have PhDs, graduates from top universities in US. Not unusual, really not unusual. And there are unusual careers, like you may become a writer, you have technology background, you can become a science fiction writer, you can become a technical writer, write for popular magazines. You've seen a little bit in Poland, that in Poland too, some of the politicians have PhDs, right?
Our president has a PhD. I think candidate Trzaskowski also has a PhD. Pawlak, I remember, has also a PhD. I'm not sure about that. He's a computer scientist anyway. Not sure if Pawlak has a PhD. But anyway, you've seen a lot of PhDs. It's an unusual career. You become a politician. That can also happen, right? Many possibilities. Universities and industrial research labs are the most common. In US, there are many industrial research labs, so majority of PhDs end up working there. Faculty positions at top universities are few, they are scarce. The competition is bigger. My feeling is that they are also getting the best people at universities, top universities, of course. Industrial research labs, again, I went for the university myself, but I've been to a good number of labs. I worked for 1.5 years for IBM, in their biggest research lab, Watson Center. I was not very impressed by the scientists there. I mean, they were good people, smart people, but I was not impressed. The atmosphere, I found that they were not working as hard, and they were a little bit, because there was money, they had money, they didn't have to struggle for money, they were a little bit lazy, I think, a little bit. Everybody, every human is subject to that. If things are too easy, you become a little bit lazier. Competition, big competition. In Poland, though, in Europe probably in general, there are fewer research centers, so most PhDs end up being at universities. And I don't think it's very difficult to get university positions. Maybe not terribly easy, but it's not terribly difficult either. So many of you probably will end up in universities once you are done with your PhD. And some will start your own companies, especially graduates of a technical university. You have maybe some good ideas which will allow you to see the commercial potential of it and start companies. Nothing wrong with any of these careers. It's essentially what you like, what you love. The social character of science. That's maybe the most important slide here. I realized that I myself was, when I was a young person, I was, of course, first a student and then a doctoral student. I had a little bit of an imagination of science being this beautiful, very clean, very, very pure thing. I was always looking up to it. It's a wonderful environment. I always wanted to be at the university. My sons, when they were teenagers, we had a lot of quarrels, of course, when you are teenagers, you don't like your parents. They were explaining to me how science works. They were thinking I'm backwards just because I'm conservative, I'm religious, and they wanted to be atheists. We had a lot of discussions. And they were explaining to me how science works. And science for them is like, you know, this pure thing that that their father doesn't has not grown up to it, essentially. Too imperfect. Science is very social, like any other scientific activity, and very imperfect. Science is as perfect as humans who are creating it. That's with many things, really, right? Some people complain about a church or the Catholic Church in Poland. The Catholic Church in Poland, the priests, are as good as the society. They're coming from the society, right? Simple rule. Scientists also are as good as the society. They are coming from the society. Maybe they are not lazy, they are working harder. Maybe they are, on the average, smarter than the rest, you know. Priests are also probably have higher moral standards than the average in the society, too. That's true. But they're coming from that society. So social character, whether or not you have made a big contribution, is judged by other people, by other scientists. And look at that. Look at politics, for example, in Poland. You notice that people are saying completely different things. They are judging one another, the statements of the other. And you can see that it's not clear to say who is right, right? They're saying often opposite things. Science is maybe not that messy, but it's also a little bit like that. You have done something good, you have described it, you want to publish it, and then another scientist gets your paper, smokes a cigar or drinks coffee and looks at, nah, I don't like it, it's, he's wrong here, right? And essentially it's a judgment by another scientist. Sometimes they will never discover the greatness of your work until you die, and they will discover it after your death. That happens, not terribly often, but it happens. You know, sometimes some contributions were appreciated many years later. I can think of a mathematician, Church, I forgot his first name, 1920s, lambda calculus, mathematical formalism, was appreciated only in 1960s when they designed the programming language Lisp. Then they thought, wow, but that's precisely like lambda calculus. They discovered his work. Things like that are happening, definitely. So whether your paper should be published, whether you should get money, a grant, whether you should get permanent position, whether you should get Doctor of Science degree, habilitatia, whether you should become a professor, it's judged by other people. Imperfect, isn't it? Research space, if you want to have your own lab at the university, that's also judged by other people, other scientists. And it's not the case that all the other scientists will kind of set aside, oh yeah, he deserves a lab. No, I want that too, right? So there is a little bit always, you know, social interaction. Sometimes it may be also a hard interaction. So always other people are judging it. Whether you should get your PhD is also judged by other people. Who are these people? Definitely your advisor. But then there will be reviewers. I think there are three reviewers with a PhD. They recruit them from other scientists, typically in Poland, but they can be also foreigners. And they will read your doctorate, and they will express their opinion whether you should get a doctorate or not. Other people. Very imperfect, isn't it? Science is not free of scoundrels. Scoundrels are, there are many synonyms of scoundrel in Poland, in Polish. Some of them are really funny, the synonyms. So there are people who are like this in science. I mean, you've seen it. There, what was there recently? Well, scientists who were teaching in Collegium Humanum. They probably had PhDs if they were on the faculty of that university. The rector, I don't know if he probably was also a PhD. Right? They were accepting money for printing diplomas, essentially. So there are people like this, but I dare to say that there are fewer of them in science than in other enterprises. Why are there fewer? The benefits are lower. There is not as much to gain as in other disciplines. So that's why I think there are fewer of them. You know, if you lie, if you cheat, the consequences of being caught are dear. You are caught in a normal environment, you are gone. You are destroyed. I doubt that whether the faculty who were involved in Collegium Humanum, the professors who were involved in that, I doubt they will get a grant, they will publish easily. Their names are probably going to be more or less public once the guilt is proven by the court. So the rewards are not very high. The consequences of being a scoundrel are not very... can be dear, so there are fewer people. Not free. I've seen scoundrels in universities. In fact, education and wisdom are sufficiently different things we can define them separately and talk about them separately. And the third thing that is very different is the personal culture. You may have noticed, I've met professors who were essentially... what would be a good word? I would say in Polish, prostak. In English, I would say simpleton, maybe. People who lacked personal culture. And culture is the way you interact with other people, essentially. And they were educated, maybe they were smart, they were intelligent, but still not very wise and not very cultured. So these are the three different concepts. And, you know, in science you can also have people who are well educated, they've gone to the highest degree, but they are lacking in other things. Maybe they are not wise. If two professors, let's say different things that are completely complements of each other, at most one of them is right, correct? That's simple logic. If this one is right, then this is wrong, right? They cannot be both right. So if you see that, it tells you that, at least one of them is not very wise. Maybe both, but... So wisdom is... and also ethical behavior can be also... but I think there are fewer in this business than in other businesses. Now, the three important mechanisms that the science uses. The first is scientific publications. You must have already gotten to know that some of you already have publications before you even got into the PhD program. You're probably working on publications, so you know that this is an important mechanism. There is this is an important thing that I know I didn't realize in the beginning. I had to learn by talking to people and kind of looking at different ways of publishing. There is a prestige ranking, importance and prestige ranking. The simplest and the least prestigious are oral presentations. So essentially, you visit your friend in Kraków and you present at Jagiellonian University, you give a seminar in a research group or in the department. That's the least prestigious. You can put it in your resume, in your vita, that's all right, but there's very little trace of it. It's just the people who were there in the audience and the announcement, that's it. Still, you should do a lot of it because it's a very, very inexpensive way of advertising your work. The more people will see what you are doing, the better. You are building your network. So absolutely you should do it. You should learn how to present. Presenting is very similar to teaching, so you will also become a better teacher when you present a lot. You should learn how to do it, and you should do it. The next one is our technical reports, web pages. So you can create a web page with your ideas, you can describe them, you can write a technical report. Many departments will give you a number. They will say technical report 2025-0305, right? Fifth report in March, they will give it a number. People from outside can request it. You can put it on your website. People can download. There is no review. You decide what to write, how to write, and you publish it. It's a publication. People can refer to it in their publications, to those technical reports. There is no review, so there is no respect. No other people have not looked at it, have not approved it, so we don't know if it's good or not, if it's right or not. Books. There may be some disagreement here, because there are fundamental books opening up a completely new discipline. But I was taught, when I was in my PhD studies by some of my colleagues, when I was finishing them, the advice was, oh, don't get into that, don't do it, because the payoff is not high enough. Essentially, a lot of work to write a book, and then you don't get that much of an acknowledgement for that from your peers, from your department, from your university. So it's not that prestigious. Books can be reviewed, usually, sometimes beforehand. Publishers want a review to learn whether there is need for that book, whether the book will sell. Sometimes they have reviews in journals. Another scientist reads that book and writes a short opinion about that book. That also happens. But generally, the reviewing process is not very strong of a book. So it's not, in that sense, it's not prestigious. Sometimes people publish a book based on their years of work. That happens also. Then there are workshops, symposia, annual meetings, and non-peer-reviewed conferences. Usually there is some review, so the organizers, the organizing committee do look at the submissions and decide, okay, this is good enough, this is not good enough. They will accept you. There is a meeting, you present your work in that scientific meeting. Sometimes there are proceedings, but sometimes there are like short abstracts, one-page abstracts, sometimes two, 3 pages. Sometimes the conferences have longer papers, but the peer review is not very strict. The people reviewing are also from that club, so not terribly respectful. Then there are major peer-reviewed conferences. Depends on the field. In computer science, my field, there are conferences that are often more prestigious than good journals. Maybe not top journals, but good journals. Very strict review process. People who know exactly that field are reviewing it because they are coming to those conferences. And they are reasonably fast and reputable. They are subject to stupid reviewers. I'm joking here. We will talk about reviewing later. The bad thing about it is that you cannot argue with them because submission deadline is March 15. Decision with review, well, reviews are given to you April 15, April 22, a week later. You have to respond with your response. The reviewers get convinced or not by your response. Typically not, that's my experience. And then your paper is rejected or accepted. The problem is that there is little time and you cannot really argue well with the reviewers. If they don't like your paper for bad reasons, they are wrong, very difficult to convince them. But they are reputable, they are good. If you have conferences like that in your field, you should publish there because it's fast turnaround, and you will also meet important people. Important, I mean knowledgeable, in the conference. They will listen to your talk, they will give you comments, etc. So definitely very advisable to do. I advise you to do oral presentations. I advise you this, definitely. And also this, which is journals. These are the final archival publications. They are in libraries. They are reviewed. The problem there is that there are leading journals like Science, Nature, even the Polish Ministry of education, not education, higher education, gave it 300 points or something, or maybe 500 even. I still think it's too few, because they are really very difficult to get in. And then there are very good journals, and they are good, and they are obscure journals. Especially recently, the last few years, there's a lot of junk journals, just junk. I'm getting every day at least 3-4 invitations. Oh, we are about to publish and we are missing one paper. Would you please send it to us? I see that some of you are saying getting the same. It's just junk, typically junk. They are landing all in the waste basket, those invitations. So you have to be careful. How do you know which of them are leading, which of them are good? Well, ask your advisor, because it depends on the field. Ask which journals are good, prestigious. The advisor will tell you. And you will learn over time. So again, I advise you to do a lot of oral presentations. They are local, you know, there's a limited audience. You can get good feedback, much better than not getting any feedback. Then I would say aim high at this, aim at good and leading journals. But also, just because of the social character of science, don't stray away from these events, especially when a new field is opening. If something is exactly in the things that you are doing, it's good to meet people. Sometimes there are meetings that are symposia where top people from the field come. Very, very narrow, worth going. So you should do all, but this is the most prestigious. This is where the points will be, depending on the field, there are also a lot of points here. And I don't mean the points from the ministry, which is changing every year. It's just, ridiculous. The real points, the prestige. people will read your papers, they will see that you are publishing in good places, they will recognize your name. These are the real points I'm talking about. The second mechanism in science that is worth talking about is grants. Grants, it is a basic mechanism in science, and it means allocating a piece of limited resources to you, so allocating money. In Europe, it's kind of organized, it's making us a little bit lazy, because we don't have to struggle to get funding for you, for PhD students. We are getting that from the ministry, right? So it's just a matter of finding good people and selecting them. But sometimes we have money in the department, there's some money for equipment, there's some money for travel. But if things are really competitive, then money is scarce, of course, always. You have to struggle for it, you have to apply, show that you can do something. And this is exactly what grants are about. Grants can be of different sizes from different places. It's an indirect way of saying to you by the funding agency that what you are doing is good and it's the right thing to do now. The timing is good, good thing. Here is the money, do it. Of course, you have certain obligations when you have a grant. You have to you have, of course, money for equipment, for travel, for doctoral students who will help you with doing things. But there are also some obligations. You have to write reports. There's a lot of bureaucracy in Europe. There's a lot of bureaucracy to the point that I just decided to myself I'm too old for that. I don't want to spend 10 hours a week on writing reports and filling out forms. I don't want to do it. But you know, you can do it. Funding agencies, they are American funding agencies, but there are equivalents of that in Europe, in Poland also. National Science Foundation is a very prestigious organization. It's like Fundacja Nauki Polskiej. They have the best, the strictest review process. Really, every grant application gets two, three reviewers. They write their opinion. The program director is a scientist himself or herself. They decide about giving you money. It's a prestigious grant, very nice. Not very large in terms of the amount of money, but very, very nice, very prestigious. A National Institute of Health, that's another one that has a very strict process. It's in health sciences, biological, chemicals, health sciences. And then there are military agencies in US, DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. Every branch of the military has money for that, for research, Navy, Air Force, Army. The grants are usually very large. These are hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars. The review process is less strict. Sometimes the decision is made by the program director. So you can do lobbying. You can visit the program director, talk to them, and convince them that they should give you the money. Sometimes there is some reviewing. But I got a grant from DARPA. I got from Air Force three or four times. The review process wasn't very strict, I remember. But money doesn't stink. You know where it comes from? Money doesn't stink? The saying? Pardon?
From Latin.
That's right. But where was it said? By whom? One of the emperors didn't have enough money in the purse, and he decided to tax the sewage. And there was some resistance among his advisors, you know, sewage, well, that's, you know, taxing sewage is like, he said, well, money doesn't stink. Sewage may stink, but not the money, right? So money doesn't stink. Foundations have usually small amount of money, on the order of $100,000, $50,000, $200,000. There are foundations created by Bill and Melinda Gates, by Carnegie, Andrew Carnegie, you know, they are focusing on fighting cancer, on social problems, on cities, usually directed small amounts of money, but also nice if you have no other sources of funding. Industrial grants. Industrial companies can also give you money, usually not very large, but they are also nice. It's not a reviewed thing. You need to know people. When you know people, you can coach them into giving you some money, essentially. And so these are American things, but I suspect there are several things that are working in Poland. Not yet. I mean, this is important. We have European sources also, but we can also get money from NATO. I don't know if you knew that. I once got a NATO grant, not very large, but it was very nice for travel. So there are several places, and these are not yet very developed in Poland, I think. At least not in technical sciences. And the third mechanism, the last one, is peer review. Peer review is very important. It's essentially letting other people judge your work. Why on earth would you do it? The reason for that is fundamentally ingrained in people. We don't, and you can see it in many places. Do you remember this quote from the New Testament, from the Bible? You can see a splinter in the eye of your brother, but you are not seeing a big pole in your own eye, right? That's a fundamental truth about people, I think. It's much easier to see problems with other people than with yourself. So much, much easier. And people need, actually, to develop well, to remain healthy, to remain normal. They need feedback from other people. You know, in Polish, in English too, we say in English, old spinster, stara panna, old bachelor, stary kawaler. What does it mean? What does it say? It says about a person, a human being, who has been isolated from the interaction with other people long enough to become essentially very strange, right? It's not about marriage, it's lack of other people around you who tell you, oh, what are you doing here? That's wrong, you shouldn't be doing this. People who are isolated from other people start deteriorating. One of the best, I would say ironically, inventions, but it's actually a sacrament in Christian, not all Christian churches, Catholic and Orthodox Church have it, confession. In Protestant churches it was eliminated, but it was a wrong thing to do, to eliminate it. Confession is one of the most important things that you get from the church. What is it? Well, you go to another human being, a priest, with a guarantee that that human being will not tell around what you said to him, yes? And you can tell what you did. Well, you know, I stole a pen from my employer. Oh, but you know, it was a small pen, and you know, it was nothing, right? And the priest says, "What do you mean a small pen? Right? You stole something. You have another human being who is not essentially, you know, you need to say it aloud, and the other human being tells you what he thinks about this." A good friend of mine told once something very ironic about humans. He said, human beings, well, first of all, they are not rational, they are rationalizing. We try to rationalize things. But he said also, intelligent people never commit sins. It's an ironic statement. I commit a sin. But I'm intelligent, so I can, well, you know, given the circumstances, given what was there, I don't think it was a bad thing to do. I had no choice. I did it, right? Try and tell it to the priest. And the priest will say, what do you mean, right? You've done wrong, yes? That's the situation. You are getting feedback that normally you would not get. Of course, if you are not a Christian going to confession regularly, it's good to have a wife or a husband. You know, you try to sell bullshit to your wife, she will tell that. A good wife will, at least. Good husband will do that too. If you are not married, a good friend, and I mean really good friend, not just a friend you go and have beer and always accept everything that you do. A friend who will tell you, your aunt, your grandmother will tell you straight what he or she thinks. Very, very important. If you don't have that, you need a therapist. In fact, Western European societies have developed this institution of therapy, a paid friendship, you can call it. Yes, you pay the money and they play this role. So in any case, humans need that, absolutely. And that is reflected also in science. A scientist needs to be corrected in his or her ideas. Peer review is precisely that mechanism. Of course, it's imperfect. It will be. It's used everywhere, publications, in grant proposals. You have to watch out conflict of interests, of course, because the reviewers may feel tempted to assimilate your ideas. I'm using this very gentle language. Steal your ideas, what I mean, really. That may happen also, other human beings. The process is imperfect, but if you are doing good things, even if they are rejected one or two times, they will eventually get out into the world. Eventually they will. I do strongly believe it. Reviewing, if you do it, and you will be doing it very soon, if you are not doing it already, do it well. It's your moral responsibility. Treat others the way you would like to be treated, just like a priest or a friend or a husband or a wife. Treat your friend, your husband, wife, the way you would be like to be treated yourself. If you criticize somebody's work, show what is a superior approach, how you would do it better. I think this is maybe the last one. I have 5 seconds, so not a lot. People expect from you a few outstanding quality contributions. Just, I think, Siri. Rather than many, many publications. So I've heard once recently that somebody in one of the departments here expects at least 8 publications from a student before you defend. I think it's a funny idea. I would defend my student as a like a lion for one publication if it was a breakthrough, absolutely important publication. People expect from you, in fact, they will not remember you for the 20 publications you had, 10 points each, but they will remember you for the one publication you had in science. Honesty, integrity, well, let's stop because I don't want to. Just let's come back to those things next week briefly, okay? So sorry for the. I'm still on time. It's 30. If anybody has not signed the list, please do so.